Good afternoon. I'd like to call the JSR 2 committee to order. I know this is a shock to everyone that we're starting not at 7 in the morning or 5 in the afternoon, but we're actually getting to be a little more normal. We're a little shy of senators, but I did see a couple here earlier. They'll be back.
When? What do you need?
Well,
we've got the right
here. First on the agenda today is Mr. Dick Nichols. Go ahead.
Chairman Mr. Lee, members of the committee, I'm Dick Nichols. I'm the manager of CQ's Bend office, Bend Water Quality Section, and with me is Bruce Hammond, who is the person at DEQ assigned to carrying out the sustainability analysis that's directed under House Bill 3720, which was enacted during the 1997-99 legislative session. Also a seat test from Farm Bureau. In February of this year, Mr. Hammond and I provided testimony concerning the general status activities prescribed in House Bill 3720. Today we offer testimony concerning specific activities relative to use of sustainability analyses, or UAA. Before we proceed, I think it's useful to establish a common background relative to Oregon's water quality standards. Oregon's water quality standards are based upon protection of all of the beneficial uses of its water bodies. With respect to any particular parameters, the standards have been set to protect the most sensitive use. In regard to water temperature, the standards have been structured to protect salmonids during both rearing and spawning life cycles. It also contains criteria for full cost, which have been even more demanding, have even more demanding temperature needs. House Bill 3720 specifies an advisory committee formed to advise the EQ on where to concentrate the UAA work as required by the legislation. The committee, called the Beneficial Use Advisory Committee, chaired by Mr. Pete Cass from the Farm Bureau, chose to comprehensively evaluate extreme temperature needs in the Oregon High Desert region and the Klamath and Lost River. More specifically, the UAA program would evaluate temperature requirements for the Lahontan Spectral Trout, southeastern Oregon, and the Red Band Trout of the Oregon High Desert region. In this biennium, our primary focus has been on the Lahontan, and in a few minutes, Mr. Hammond will provide the details and some conclusions from that work. Okay. Before that, however, let me tell you where we go from here. First, we intend to prepare a final report concerning the proposed temperature criteria for the Lahontan. That information will be submitted to DEQ's Water Quality Standards Policy Committee for its review. And assuming that the committee concurs with the proposed criteria, we will go to rulemaking and add the Lahontan criteria to the temperature standard for those basins where Lahontan spectral trout exist. And as you also know, the EPA, once we adopt the criteria, then we have to send it to EPA for their approval. And since Lahontan is a listed fish, they will have to consult, in this case, with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Relative to the red band, we are intending to begin work, that work this summer. We have used funds from the Governor's Watershed Enhancement Board to purchase water quality monitoring equipment and establish contracts with various researchers to conduct a census of stream populations of red band trout, develop benchmarks for stream habitat quality, and to obtain information about the temperature needs of the red band trout. Finally, to the extent we are able on our expected budget, we'll be conducting water quality monitoring of various selected streams containing red band trout. And then with that, I'd like to introduce Bruce Hammond, who will go through something.
And prior to that, let me see if we have any questions at this point. Any questions of the committee? Mr. Nichols, I have a question. Are you seeing any patterns here, or is there any issues coming out that might apply to other basins besides those you're looking at?
At least on the Lahontan petrel trout, we're going to be able to extrapolate from the streams that we're working on, we think, to other streams. The red band, we're still pretty early in that. There's a number of different populations, and it's going to be a little more, I think, complicated than the Lahontan. But we're hoping to be able to take the work that we do and extrapolate it to the other basins where these are species and subspecies that shift.
I realize it's really, yes, to really go out to many conclusions. Thank you. Any other questions? Go ahead.
Chairman Messley, members of the committee, what I'd like to do is run through about 10 or 12 slides for you to give you an overview.
I need your name for the record, sir.
It's Bruce Hammond.
Bruce Hammond.
And I'm a field biologist out of Pendleton, and I've been working in youth sustainability for the last 14 months. And what I'd like to do today, using the overhead projector, is to give you a sense of what the broader goals and objectives of the Youth Sustainability Analysis Program is all about, and give you a sense of what we found in our field studies in Willow Creek, and then finally give you a sense of where we'd like to go in terms of the red band trout. The most sensitive uses are the Lahontan and cutthroat trout and the red band trout, so we're going to focus on them primarily as we go through today. Any questions?
As practice to getting into slides, I want to say that the advisory committee that we work with is chaired by Michelle at UCSD. And a year ago, we started working with Pete and the advisory committee, which is a very diverse group of individuals from tribes to fish land itself to agriculture and OSU range, and a number of folks of diverse backgrounds and interests. We went to them and said, okay, this hasn't been done, what do we do? How do we approach this? We can go out and we can find some fairly quick and easy examples and be successful, or do we look longer term and try to build on something substantive? And it was fairly resounding from that committee that they viewed it as an opportunity to really take a look at the Clean Water Act in detail and analyze how we approach development standards in our area, so that we have premature criteria that meet the needs of the fish, which is absolutely critical, but also are not overly protective or under protective uses. In some cases, in fact, the standards may be higher than current standards, or in some cases lower. What we try to do is develop the science so that we understand how systems function and how fish, which is the most sensitive use, relate to water quality. And then we from there we hear out later. Having said that, UA sustainability analysis program will refine the designated uses in the high desert ecoregion by classifying streams cold, cool, water in the system based on the most sensitive needs, which are general specific. The second is to develop temperature criteria for each of these classifications. And in fact, what this will do is right now in the high desert ecoregion, which is which includes now here Kearney and Lake County and part of Clarence County. So most of Southeast Florida, those areas right now have a temperature standard that is cold water, that's 64 degrees. What this program recognizes across that broad region is that not one shoe size fits all. And in fact, there is probably a tier of temperature standards that would fit into these classifications. So it's a departure from where we stand today with one standard, say for rearing of salmonids or trout species. We would have three. And each of those standards would be attached to a particular type of ecosystem. Might be a cold system, it might be a warm system, or it might be a cool system. Are recognized that not one shoe size for all. And the final important factor is the integrated feedback process. We think it's extremely important to go out and talk to people that live in the community, that the biologists that are actually working, the land management agencies, ODFW, talk to the ranchers, talk to whoever will listen to us about their experience on the land and their community. So those three keys, we want to be able to classify the ecosystem to account for the diversity in the aquatic systems in Southeast Oregon. We want to develop temperature criteria to protect those uses that don't overly protect. And then finally, again, integrate people into the process. The objectives of the program are to conduct water body surveys, quantify the relationship between water quality and the health of resident fish populations, so that we begin to understand when we have a standard in Oregon, is that actually protecting that use? Or are we kidding ourselves by saying, if we meet this level, is it really going to protect that fish? An important part, an important objective, is to conduct research. That the best way to get through some of the controversial arguments and better understand how to protect the resource is through research, not just going out and looking at water quality, but understanding what these fish need, and not fish that are located in Michigan or Maine, but that are native to Oregon. And I can't emphasize that enough. We're working on the understanding that fish have natural range variability. And that what we're trying to do is capture and understand that range of variability so that as we develop our standards, we account for that. And again, involve people in the process, not only in giving us guidance and input on where we go from here, but also once we've found certain things, once we've been in the field, we go back to them for ground truth and say, does this make sense? And the first approach that we take, and this is required under the Clean Water Act as part of use sustainability, is to assess the physical, chemical, and biological factors that affect the attainment of uses. We go in, we look at the function of the system, we look at water quality, we look at stream characteristics, we look at all the properties that make up the watershed, including the riparian area, management, land use, etc. And then in relation to that, we look at the health of the fish. Are those uses being met? There probably are some cases in Oregon where we have standards, in fact, that are stream temperatures that exceed the state standards, yet those fish populations are healthy and viable and reproducing. And that's what we're trying to quantify and to define certain relationships. In relation to water quality, are those fish healthy? And under what circumstances are they healthy? And the other side of that is, what circumstances are they not healthy? What kinds of things do we see that are detrimental to the fish? As, again, the most sensitive year. And this component, again, uniquely applying fish research to species in Oregon. And what we do is we look at not just laboratory studies or field studies. We try to get a range of different kinds of field evaluations and experiments so that we understand from the point which there's absolutely no impact fish to that point which is lethal to fish. And you can't do that purely in the laboratory context. So what we try to do is we break up the research to look at optimal conditions in the laboratory. Under what conditions do they respond to temperature? How do they react in the laboratory? What kinds of stress signals do they give us? We are planning to do work this summer in the field to actually quantify fish response to temperature in the field and actually with streams in Eastern Oregon as part of the ecoregion. We'll be subjecting fish to stress under various conditions. And monitoring those responses to get an idea how well can they survive, and what limits their growth and viability. And I have to say that, as Dick mentioned, the folks at GWEB, we managed to get some money to get the research people involved in this project, and it has been absolutely overwhelming, the interest. We have Oregon State University that is participating in the research. They've changed a lot of their priorities to help on this because they recognize that there may be a lot of merit in understanding for species what those fishes are capable of handling, as well as Portland State University, Idaho State University, the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife Research folks. And so we've had a tremendous amount of response to the research component, specifically with those fish in mind. And the final thing that we do is we look at the population level. How do fish and streams respond to temperature? And so this summer we're going to be doing some telemetry work where we actually track populations of fish, where they move, how they move, under what circumstances they move, including temperature, and some of the changes in water quality that we see. So research goes from the laboratory to the field. And the final important part of our approach involving people in the process, the people that we're working with include watershed councils, environmental groups, affected communities, land streams, land managers, the BLM, the U.S. Forest Service, folks that are out there, have been out there for a lot of many years that we're trying to learn from. And finally, we're working with universities and fish biologists to learn from them as well. Any questions at this point?
How many questions, Mr. Hammond? If not, thank you.
Okay. Now we'll move to kind of the specifics of the work that we've done. We committed to do a yeast sustainability analysis on Willow Creek. It's located in Trout Creek Mountain. Those of you not familiar with where that's at, it's in Kearney County by the Nevada-Oregon border. It's in the high desert. The stream is only about 20 miles long. The resident fish is Lahontan pepper trout. It's the only fish in the stream. Helps us to better understand how to behave the temperature stresses. And the listing status, the Lahontan pepper trout has been listed since 1975. It's threatened, and it's on the stream itself is on the Oregon 303 D list, or water quality impaired list, and the temperature. The ownership is predominantly public, but also we have, there's a ranch, a large ranch, and that have land joining the stream, and they're cooperating with us. The land use is, there's a, in certain part of the stream, there's a lot of wild horses. It's a very remote area. In fact, they're locked into this area. They can't get out. As well, there's cattle grazing, there's controlled management, and you'll see some of the benefits of management to the condition of it. This is a section of Willow Creek that kind of gives you a frame of reference for what we're talking about. And this area, by the way, is managed, there is grazing on this section of ground. We're in this area, so you can get a sense that what we're trying to do in these projects is look at coexistence in terms of land management and also balancing environmental interests and taking care of the needs of fish. And the star of the show is the Lahontan cutthroat trout. This is what the little creature looks like. It's only about 12 inches long. And they live about 3 or 4 years in the shore. In Oregon, the Lahontan cutthroat trout is at the very edge of its range. Normally, these fish are distributed down into California.
Question? You talked about the variability of fish. You talked about the variability in terms of temperature.
Yes.
There's variability about the habitat also. In the question plays itself out with the various listings You know, we learned quite a bit about the range of the spotted owl and the marbled neural rat. We learned a little about the snowy plover. We learned a little more about various species that occasionally visit Oregon, like lynx, but we've never documented a breeding habitat, a breeding parrot and habitat is. The Wisconsin spectro trout, which is the outside edge of this variable, wouldn't that necessarily expand and contract with normal climate fluctuations, normal climatological changes like greater or lesser rainfall? Can you see a variability in habitat boundaries over time?
Absolutely.
Okay. Are we approaching management for all species everywhere, all the time, in all conditions?
I can answer, and I'm not sure, I'm not sure if I'm understanding your second question. What we are trying to account for is that range of variability, specific to the Wahoo Chester Trout in Willow Creek, and we will extrapolate that to other Wahoo Chester Trout streams. And we're using our characters and string characterization studies to figure out what things we can extrapolate and what we cannot. And what we have so far is that we can extrapolate to 11 other streams based on this work. And the next step is to do exactly that same approach with the Red-Tailed Trout, but not to try to take on a broader universe of Chinook salmon. I probably still have an answer to you.
Let me clarify it for you.
Okay.
The question I've got is that we can do a lot of adaptive management. We're very good at manipulating a terraform. We can probably push a standard if we focus on, if you want cooler water or more abundant water in the spring. We can change the management regime in the riparian area and force that variable out, because the temperature down, the volume up. But if we're doing those things in absence of any information about the trend and condition of the peak over the long term, and I can't even get a straight answer about whether we're going into or out of a global warming period, or into and out of, or out of a global wetting period, or into and out of a global cooling period. So the trend and condition overall is a bit elusive. What I'm seeing is a desire by a particular individuals to focus on particular species and manipulate the landscape to benefit that species. And sometimes it's a very outer range of its historic range of variability. It's a very outer edge of that. And it seems like we're putting an awful lot of burden in manipulating the landscape to optimize conditions for species that may be a very outer edge of its normal range of variability. Because I've spent an awful lot of research for pretty small research.
And I tend to agree with you. Let me say, first of all, why we focus on the Wisconsin, because it was quantified. And secondly, in terms of the natural range of variability, when we get into the conclusion we're finding, what we really found is exactly what you're saying. If we were to apply Oregon 64 degree standard, for example, Willow Creek,
we
never get there.
Are we going to build a new standard so we can get there?
Yes. Next slide.
We have one more question, Mr. Hammer. Representative Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you go back to the slide of Willow Creek that you had?
Okay. Okay, I don't need enough of it
here. It should be that one right there. The picture.
Oh, the actual one. Okay. No, I'm fine. I didn't get this up right. I was lucky for that.
Backwards, I wouldn't know if I was different.
Okay.
How much, this is a 20 mile thing, how much of it looks like that?
Two-thirds.
I guess that looks like pretty prime riparian habitat to me.
It is. It's a remarkable system that for about 130 years or something like that has been intensively managed for sheep, cattle, and it was overgrazed. And what happened in 1989, the Bureau of Land Management changed Willow Creek to manage for riparian values. And so this system is only 10 years in recovery, and it is absolutely remarkable how fast and how quickly it is coming around.
So Bruce, how far down from the headwaters is this picture?
This would be probably about one third, somewhere around 8 to 9 miles from the very headwaters.
Mm-hmm.
And again, this is land that's managed. Mm-hmm. And the old way of doing business was that they would allow the livestock sources in the stream while you're around. And what happens now is that up to about April 15th, there are the same amount of animal units in the stream, but they take them off after April 15th and during the summer months so that you don't have animals actually in the riparian area. And they get their animal units, the fish are allowed their habitat and their way of life. But one problem we do have, that has not happened down below. The lower one-third of the stream does have some water quality problems, and I'll talk about that as well.
Yeah, I guess, Mr. Chair, I just find it amazing, and I'm familiar with his management style, that picture right there is in the 303D list.
Actually, this section is probably pretty darn close to okay. We can
But it's still on the list.
Mr. Chair, Representative King, when I first looked at that, I see a lot of brush, apparently. I don't see any trees, but then that might be a tree that's on the right, and I was just wondering, you know, if it does have trees or no trees, or if there's any reason why.
It does have trees, and what I personally learned about this system when I went in to start with it, how important it is to go in and look at a system based on its capabilities, natural potential. You can grow trees in the upper part of the watershed, and there are mountain poplar, there are aspen, a number of large bushes, bush types that are in the upper part of the watershed. But as you move down, the character of the vegetation changes, the willow species change, they go from being mature, very high willow species, to the very lowest elevation, which is a smaller willow. And what we did as part of our trying to understand the system was to characterize that based on its natural potential, not impose our values on it, to say, we're going to raise an old growth forest that's very long in the spring. For willow or anything else, we looked at its natural capability, and that's how we actually developed the management plan. And those are the targets that are needed to be met under the management.
And we have one more question. I want to caution the committee, we've got a full agenda today, and we're running over our time frame right now, but Representative Lundquist?
Go ahead.
Are you okay? Mr. Hammond, if you could try to kind of wind down or wind up here a little bit.
Happy to reply.
It's very useful information.
Okay, I will move through it quickly. Just to give you a sense of the kind of work that goes into this, we conduct water quality surveys, we do comprehensive stream surveys, looking at temperature, the full length of the stream. We work with folks like ODFW at Oregon State University to quantify the fish that are there, the habitat, and we put in weather stations so that we understand what the natural climate regime looks like for that particular area, not applying weather to other areas. And something we did in this case, we had Dr. Jason Dunham of the University of Nevada go through and do a literature review on the Lahunt Pepper Cross to try to figure out what his life history needs are so that whatever standard we develop, we're ensuring that we take care of the species and his greatest life history needs. So those are things that went into the report, went into the analysis, a few things. Our findings. Natural conditions preclude attainment of Oregon temperature criteria of 54 degrees. The Lahunt cutthroat trout survive and grow in stream temperatures that exceed that temperature. Grazing by cattle and wild horses impact the lower one-third section of the stream, and use by fish is impaired in the lower one-third section of the stream. And our recommendations include adopt temperature criterion of 58 degrees to protect the Lahontan cutthroat trout to accommodate for its natural range of variability and its range. Implement a total maximum daily load and management plan to meet the revised criteria. What that means basically that the goal is set at 68, not 64, and in this particular case, it's going to be simply a matter in the upper two-thirds section of continuing existing management, allowing the recovery to happen as it is. It's remarkable, as I mentioned. And then there will be things that are required in the lower one-third because basically there is no vegetation in the lower third. And then what we hope to do is apply the revised criteria for other streams to bear Lahontan cutthroat trout. And that's pretty much for just the Willow Creek that we are proposing a revised temperature standard for not only Willow Creek but other Lahontan bearing streams. Where do we go from here? This is a critical piece of this particular program because what we've learned and what we can then apply to ridgeland trout streams, which are more widely distributed. In the case of, to give you just an example of Lahontan cutthroat trout, we probably have 300 miles of streams with Lahontan cutthroat trout where the revised criteria will apply at 58. But with the red band trout, which we hope to look at in more detail, emphasizing water quality studies, the field research and working with people, we're looking at close to 2,000 miles of streams that are going to be impacted by the work that we do in characterizing their habitat and their temperature. One of the components, the redband trout is a candidate for looking. We hope to be able to better understand the habitat range of these fish. It's most widely distributed. The literature and some data today highlight the fact that they're warm adapted fish, that they've evolved in a fairly harsh environment over time, and that we need to be able to account for those that range of variability in the standards that are used to protect them. And we right now have major momentum with universities, agencies, and watershed councils that think we're doing the right thing. And I'm going to try to cut this down a little more and summarize for you. In terms of the broader ecoregion project, the goal is to refine the temperature criteria to protect the sensitive uses in this area. Go to a tiered approach where you account for different types of communities that exist in Southeast Oregon, including cold, cool, and warm water communities. So you end up having a temperature criteria for each of those tiers versus now the single standard for semi-arid rearing. The objective is to develop a scientific basis for the criteria, work with people, and the outcome will be site-specific temperature criteria.
Any questions from the committee?
Okay.
Senator Ferriero?
Yes, this was talked about just before I came in, Mr. Chairman, but red band trout. I've heard that there's a number of species being described as red band. Why are we trying to manage for a variety of species? Is red band just a generic name for a trout that you find in high desert streams, or is it a family? Is it a genus? Is it a phenotype? What is a red band?
It's a subspecies. Technically, it's an inland rainbow trout, east of the Cascades. Most trout are red band trout. It's a subspecies of the rainbow trout. There are a number of genetic lineages of these fish. They come from the Snake River, they come from the Columbia River, they come from the Pitt and Sacramento Rivers in California, and there's a Fort Ross population that came through the Deschutes at one time and in Central Oregon, and is now isolated in the desert. My point is there are a number of different lineages of red band trout, and in fact, last week we spent 6 days with Dr. Robert Benchy, a national authority on trout species, including red band trout, and universities, going to each of those dates and trying to quantify the studies in relation to the genetics of that system, so that whatever work that we do, we're able to apply to those genetic lands, either avoiding hatchery or hybridized trout because they're not predictable, but we can look at genetic risk within the same subspecies and say, this cousin is related to this cousin, is related to this cousin, but not that one. We'll stay away from that one in terms of how far we can extrapolate our results across those genetic lands.
Senator Ferrer, maybe I can expand on that a little bit, because, you know, I think we can, in the choice that we'll have, we can take and use, because I understand different populations have different temperature needs or may have different temperature needs. We can take them as a whole and then adopt the criteria that fits the most sensitive ones, or perhaps we can break them up into separate groups and define a particular criteria for the individual populations, which may give us a little more flexibility to establish the criteria and the management plan to go along with it. That's it. We have that choice, and it seems to us to be able to dream, right, to figure out, you know, it just makes sense to break them up into populations that have different numbers. Keep it on the left.
Pete Test?
Co-Chairman Mesley, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Pete Test, Associate Director of Governmental Affairs for the Oregon Farm Bureau, and the Chairman of the Sustainability Advisory Committee for DEQ. And I'll be really brief with mine because I was here to one, ask for money, but I think I'll try and go to tell you why. When we started this whole temperature standard process 3 to 4 years ago, and we found out that they were going to have one-size-fit-all with a questionable standard, one of the key issues raised by everyone was not everything should be the same. We've got to somehow get site-specific. How can a trout in eastern Oregon be held to the same standard temperature-wise as something in western Oregon where you have 90 inches of rainfall somewhere, or can they? Can different species be the same? The red band, I was always taught, was a trout that was expected to be able to survive at a higher optimum temperature than other trout species. The data just wasn't there. This is the only way we're going to be able to reach the point where we can legally move those standards based on the way the Federal Clean Water Act works. Use sustainability analysis is the only way or off-ramp for a 303D listing, which is changing a standard to be site-specific to protect the beneficial use. It's our only way out of this right now. Other states have used it. They don't have the complexities. Very few states have done use sustainability analysis. The obvious reason we just saw here, it's not easy. I kind of look at this as kind of learning to crawl before you walk or run. We did pick streams that were obviously different so we could see what we have to investigate, so we can build the case, make the change. We'll expand to the red band, which seems pretty obvious and is one that's kind of really a problem with a potential listing coming down the road. Again, a fish that we feel quite certain probably has some differences in ability to temperature. And each time we do one of these, we come closer to the ability to move to where it's not quite as easy to determine, like the west side, where we have different populations and a climate that's totally different, and have to apply this there. So I'm really, from a standpoint of agriculture and those people that own lands that have 303D listed streams that are under the gun to reach what I would consider in some cases standards that are not reachable or attain goals that aren't reachable and eliminate the frustration that that takes with it, we have to have something to move us towards more reasonable standards. And I see this as our only way out right now. For that reason, we are very, very supportive of trying to get this budgeted, somehow get some money to continue this program. Early on in the session, we did not know how 66 money was going to be put out or how much is there, and we still don't. We did put together a bill, generally, to just say, please fund $365,000 in this program because it's already in the statute, but that was probably not the way to do it. So in the process of determining funding for 66 projects and others, we can only beg you to really consider that this be a high item. It's not a lot of money, but it's an issue that will help reduce a lot of the fears and anxiety and unhappiness with the people out there because we're moving towards developing standards that are reasonable that will help the fish and also keep our people on the land working. With that, I'll end this and any questions you might have.
From your discussions and your work on the committee, is it your sense that, that this use sustainability will hold up in court?
Chairman Mazely, I think it will. First, it's got, they've got good data, they've got good strong data to back it up. The law allows it. It has never been challenged on any other state that I know of, and with a lot less data to do it. So I can only say that it is my feeling that it will, and if it's done properly, and that's the key to getting the Serena HUD look properly.
Thank you very much. Very interesting. I wish we had more time to spend on this subject. I think it's
thank you. We would like to go from the data.
Okay. Yeah. Sure. Appreciate that. I'd like to call Jay Nicholas. And Jay, I'm running way over. If you can help me catch up some time, I'd appreciate it. But we want the full report, too.
Yes, sir. Chair Messerly, Chair Ferraioli, for the record, I'm Jay Nicholas. I'm the Oregon Plan Project Leader. And also for the record, after the meeting, I do have baby pictures, if anybody's interested. But in the interest of time, I won't show them to the full committee.
Although, Mr. Chair, it could be a benefit that it is a cute kid.
I should explain to the committee that we started 15 minutes late, though, because he was showing us the pictures. So.
Thank you for inviting me to come and talk to you about the Oregon Plan. I will make my remarks currently brief. Those of you who have worked with me for the last 3 to 4 years will recognize that as time goes on, I like to use fewer words and more pictures. I've given you a copy of my briefing paper here, and it starts with my version of the Oregon Plan, which is clean water, salmon, and people. It all adds up, and it's Oregon's choice. The first thing I'd like to do is remind you why we're doing this annual report. We made a promise to people of Oregon that we would be accountable. We made commitments, we made promises. We told them we would give them information each year on how we were doing. This is part of that commitment. We also want to inform enough people about what we're doing so that we can increase our range of support and participation. Our challenge is in this brief report is to be accurate, balanced, and frank. We have other information that is more detailed. This is an example of some of that information. This is several hundred pages of documents describing measure by measure the work that state and federal agencies have committed to and what their status of this work is. There will be another report that will be available summarizing the results of all the restoration projects that were reported on by watershed councils, SWCDs, agencies, timber industry. As you also know, the IMFT is producing some reports. And this brief report contains a number of references to websites or email addresses where interested parties can get more detailed information. They can obtain more data if they're interested. For your information, I've summarized some of the themes that are present throughout this report. I think it's important that folks get some of these messages, and so I've worked at leaving these themes in throughout the report. And for those that don't have this handout, I'll just briefly mention them. One of the themes is who should be involved. Basically, it's all Oregonians. A watershed health is not something that can be addressed or resolved by individual interest groups. It's going to take all of us. What's at stake? Healthy watersheds basically are the foundation of healthy communities, economies, and fish and wildlife populations. Connecting neighbors. Our watersheds, to be healthy, have to work from the headwaters to the estuary. People have to understand this before we can get past the the situation of managing portions of watersheds depending on land ownership or interest. Science? Well, what we do has to make sense science-wise. It may be fun, it may be popular, but if the science doesn't make sense, we're in trouble. No quick fixes. There are some things we can resolve fairly quickly, but there are some aspects of our watershed that we will probably never change. That in some respects have been changed by the last 150 years of human development here. So resolving some of those issues will take time. And finally, it's Oregon's choice. While the Oregon Plan is founded on a basis of existing federal and state regulations, and we've made a commitment to improve compliance with those laws, what we're maintaining is that if people believe in this and want to do it, voluntary action by the folks out there in the cities and on the ground will do more than the laws alone could. On the second page, I've listed some of the highlights listed in the report. As you all know, the scope of the Oregon Plan now is expanded to statewide scope. We started out on the coast looking at coho salmon, and now we're really dealing with watershed health issues statewide and all salmonids. And what I keep emphasizing to people, it isn't just about fish. It isn't just water quality. It's watershed health. And if you have watershed health, then you will have clean water, sustainable farming, sustainable timber, sustainable communities, and so on will follow. We have 45 SWCDs and 92 watershed councils statewide. They are on the forefront of implementation on the ground. We also have a variety of local action groups that don't label themselves in either of these matters. There's very little on this list that is actually new type of efforts. Almost everything listed here has been going on before. But what we've done with the Oregon Plan is we've worked to connect people and give them a comprehensive, kind of give them the big picture to connect them to improve efficiencies and improve priorities. And so we have culvert work going on, whereas in the past, culverts would be addressed sporadically, depending on personalities or local funding available. Now we have culverts being addressed on a much more comprehensive manner, with not only much more money being available, but people talking to each other among state and federal agencies and private landowners and industries so that we can fix the most important culverts to fix first. Screening irrigation diversion, placing large wood in stream, improving road surfaces to reduce erosion, working on Senate Bill 1010 plans on agricultural land, working on alternatives to push-up dams. Push-up dams are not a problem in many parts of Oregon, but in localized areas, they are a problem to fish. We've had a number of very successful projects, some in the John Day, some in the Rogue Valley, where landowners are getting involved with infiltration galleries or gravity feed systems or pumping systems to replace push-up dams. So they get the water they need, the water they have rights to, and the fish have access that they didn't before. NRCS and the watershed and the SWCDs are continuing the work they've always been doing on conservation plans. Some folks didn't realize this, but you know, if farmers are working to keep topsoil on their farm, keep their farms productive, reduce the amount of water that they need to use for irrigation, that's good for them, and it winds up being good for the streams and the fish, too. We have miners working to reduce stormwater problems, big cities and small working on their stormwater and their municipal treatment system, step volunteers, doing everything from collecting broodstock, rearing fish, collecting data, habitat improvement projects, education programs. OSU has been part of this from the beginning, and they're continuing to help out. We're continuing to collect compliance data on our environmental laws. We're not really sure what all that means yet, but it's a new commitment, and we're working on it. Providing support for local monitoring by watershed councils and others, and the IMFT producing reports. Among the topics that they've looked at so far are predators, hatcheries, and monitoring. So those are a few examples that kind of give you a picture of how broad the interest groups that are working on it. Well, I like to talk, we've got close to different interests working on a common goal. We've got people all over Oregon. We have a long ways to go, but I'm really pleased with what we've seen so far.
Jay, I want to ask you a question. Some of your numbers seemed rather low to me, just my first blush at them. Was the source of your information from watershed associations and SWCBs, or because my guess is that there's an awful lot of work that's done out there that never shows up in our records.
That's correct. We up until last year, we didn't even have a statewide reporting system. Now we have one. We sent a plea out to watershed councils, SWCDs, timber companies, state and federal agencies. We think we're getting fairly good response from the watershed council. The SWCDs have several friends who said, you know, Jay, we're doing a lot of work, but we're not taking the time. We're so busy working, we're not taking the time to fill out the report. We also hear that there are a number of landowners who have been doing restoration work. They're still doing it. They don't want to fill out a form, number one. And number two, it's not just filling out the form, but they don't want government intrusion. So you're correct. There is a lot of work going on out there that simply isn't being reported yet.
Thank you. And I guess follow up on that question, how does that impact when we report to NIMS and other agencies, EPA and others? Do they recognize that there's an awful lot of work that is being done through the Oregon Plan that will not show up in the record books?
I think it depends on which individuals you work with in, for example, the National Fisheries Service. Some of the individuals I work with, they recognize it. They don't know how to account for it. Others, if they don't have documentation, they don't believe it. I think in overall terms, NIMS will be looking at the condition of the watersheds and the condition of the fish populations rather than how many projects we're doing when they're evaluating our success, as we will be doing as well.
Okay. Any other questions? Did you have more to present? Jay, do you have a sense from, and I know you've been around the countryside and talked to fishermen and commercial and sports and landowners, is there a sense that we're winning this battle, or is there a sense that we're doing good things but not getting at the real core of the issue?
It's very difficult for me to give you a statewide answer to that. I tend to get very different answers in little pockets where I go, and I hear both those stories. Another story, one of the versions you didn't mention is folks who say, what the heck is that Oregon Plan anyway? Most of the folks that I've worked with know what the Oregon Plan is, because when I go on tours, they take me to the folks that are doing the restoration work. They're already on board. They may or may not be in a watershed council, but they're committed. They're doing things. When we have folks come through the state fair, when we have folks that we talk to in county fairs around the state, we find a lot of landowners, city folks, that don't know what the Oregon Plan is yet. Among those that are active, I don't think very many of them are saying, going around giving each other high fives, saying, yep, we got it lit. Most of the people I talk to recognize that we're trying to balance some extremely complex issues, and we're trying to consider people's needs as well as environmental needs. Nothing that's ever been done on this grand scale before, and they're a little bit nervous. I'd say they're optimistically pessimistic.
Any other questions from the committee? Thank you very much, Jay. It's a very attractive report. Have a comment?
By the way, that summer cover was paid for by stakeholders, not by state board.
I have a comment from Senator Kocher.
Actually, just the graphics, the design, the readability, the fact that each page is a straight story that flows you into it, use of the photography and the graphics. I assume that you did the design on that.
If I could claim full responsibility for it, I would, but Michael O'Mealy and John Ledges worked with me very closely on this. Each one of us shared a lot of the vision in here, and we really tried, you know, after producing thousands of pages that sit on shelves and baffle people, I really wanted to produce something that would be more reachable to regular people, including myself, and this was, I had some great good help.
And Mr. Chairman, other than a couple of pictures on the front end, I thought the whole thing was pretty nice.
I agree.
That's the only thing that's very demo.
That's any proof?
Yeah, well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to thank Jay for the work he's done. I think he has gone kind of beyond the call in his desire to go out, and you have been to all of Oregon looking at what's being done here, and that's not necessarily normally the way people in Salem operate, and I really appreciate your willingness to fully understand the issues, and it's been very helpful.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Representative Leonard.
Yeah, this is a, thank you, Mr. Chair, good book, but I'm looking inside this one page. I have a couple questions. I see a picture here of Senator Ferrioli and Representative Meserly. Curious how old that picture of Representative Meserly is.
It's not as old as the picture of Bill Bach.
Actually,
that picture was taken in January.
Oh, I didn't say that. I think it's time to change the agenda. I have one other observation you might like, Mr. Chair. Both of you have a quote here, and it's just interesting without looking at the actual language that Senator Ferrioli is exactly twice as long as you.
That's certainly by accident. You've had enough fun.
Okay. I'll be quiet again.
And I would say that there's only important stuff folks who read.
I'd like to call Dr. Norris forward, please.
Good afternoon, my voice is Senator Ferrioli. Members of the committee, thanks for having me come back and chat with you just briefly here today. I will be brief. I had a couple of points I wanted to...
people in the audience can't hear as much as you want.
Okay. Maybe you pull it in a little closer to the door, too. How's that? That'd be a little better? That's fine. All right, good. Thank you. I had a couple of points I wanted to cover with you today. One, I understood you had a particular interest in the monitoring report that the team produced earlier. I'll say a couple of words about that and then primarily attempt to respond to your questions. I wanted to bring you up to date briefly on a couple of the key projects that we're working on, and then I put together really something you had requested a while back, some budget projections for the team for the biennium. First of all, with respect to the monitoring report, I won't say much about it. I really would prefer to respond to your questions. My only comment I'd like to make is that the team indeed was quite impressed with the degree to which the various agencies and people from the agencies of state were able to come together
and begin to focus on the monitoring that's a terribly important part of the Oregon plan. I guess if there's a challenge that the IMST would put forth to the monitoring group, it would be to be sure that we in fact have a well-integrated program of monitoring that's focusing particularly on the goals of the Oregon plan, as opposed to being simply an aggregation of a number of things that individual agencies and entities were doing that sounds like they relate to fish, so surely they're part of the Oregon plan. So our point would be it's a great place to start that way, and it's a very logical way to begin, but I think the program has matured to the point now it really needs to move beyond that, and we've outlined a number of steps in our report that we think would help with that. So maybe this would be, maybe I should just stop at that point and attempt to respond to your questions about the monitoring report.
Are there any questions regarding monitoring from the committee? Well, I guess we don't seem to have any interest right now.
Okay. If they come up later, obviously, we'd be pleased to respond to them. And let me just bring you up to date on a couple of projects, and then I'll pass out the our projections for budget for the coming biennium. There are several key projects that we're deep in process at the moment, and in fact are going to be completed in this calendar year. One is the forestry or the forest practices project, the one where we're looking at the scientific basis for the Forest Practices Act administrative rules, as well as the voluntary portions of that program that are in the Oregon plan. A second very key project is the one that we've called Escapement, but it's really its adult escapement and has extremely important implications for numbers of spawners that come back to freshwater and the implications of spin-off of that with respect to commercial fishing and sport fishing and any number of other issues where impacts on escapement might be come to bear. A third one is a project that we're calling the Temperature Standards Project. We know that that's a terribly important one for the state and of great interest to you, and that's a project that we do expect to complete in this calendar year. And the final project that I expect we'll complete in this year, I'm fairly certain about these four, are the ones that we're calling lowlands and estuarine systems. And so recognizing that that particular project really spun out of the early emphasis of our work on COVO and recognizing the importance of those particular portions of the aquatic system to the recovery of those species. So we're carrying that work forward and expect to complete that this year. Now, those projects that I mentioned are ones that will produce the in-depth technical reports that you've seen examples of those before. So those are fairly lengthy and fairly detailed. Just as an example, what you can anticipate, the forestry project report is currently at about 90 pages in length. I think each of the others are going to be probably in that range, so they're fairly complex reports. There are some other types of reports we do that I think are also very helpful. Those we call letter reports, and I anticipate several of those yet in this year. One is going to be one that will speak to the Oregon plan in general. And the team has increasingly realized there are some questions of a scientific nature that we have about the Oregon plan. For instance, we believe that for scientific reasons, there needs to be a more clear articulation of the specific goals of the plan, so that we have concrete measures that are able to be used to know about the degree to which the state is, in fact, attaining the goals that it's working so hard towards. Second is we've increasingly become aware of the importance of increased coordination of management and voluntary programs and regulations that really operate across the landscape. So the way that our government is structured at the moment, it tends to be very kind of land use oriented. And while that indeed is a very useful and efficient way to proceed, there are a number of questions that really cut across a lot of those uses. This came particularly to our attention as we began to do work on the Willamette as a system and met with and did some testimony before the Willamette Restoration Initiative and began to see that here's a prime example where we point out where here is a system that indeed cuts across all the major elements of the landscape within which these fish operate. So we think that's a particularly important one. Two others I'll mention, gravel mining project that's of a fair degree of importance in several quarters. I think there'll be a two-step process here. One, a letter report in this year that I think will be a preliminary report only to emphasize some areas where we believe additional work is going to be needed. And then anticipate a more detailed technical report that will probably be in the year 2000 about gravel mining. And finally, in the area of hatcheries and hatchery operations, we've reported once on hatcheries, although it had a particular thrust to that report, if you might remember. What we'll do in our next report is to comment probably fairly briefly on the hatchery audit that is currently been, or is being, and I believe is now completed by the Oregon Department of Fisheries and Wildlife. And then as part of that, I anticipate that the team is likely to call for a more clear articulation from the department on the role of hatcheries and hatchery programs as they're important in achieving the goals of the Oregon plan. Finally, there are four projects that I believe will be initiated in this year. One deals with agricultural lands and land uses, an enormously large and complex project. When I think about the challenges we've had in the forestry project, I get very nervous about taking on the ag lands project because it's just so complex and so diverse. The second one I think will be a very major one as well, urban lands, and then two others that I think will probably be smaller in scope. One is the detailed monitoring protocols and the scientific adequacy of those for particular measures, and the wild fish management policy of the state. So there's a host of other kinds of activities, as you know, that are kind of ongoing sorts of things. So preparing an annual report of the work of the team. We're also obligated to produce an annual monitoring report, which we think will be quite different than the one that we produced in this year. And then there continue to be requests to review a fairly large number of reports and proposals. So that's basically, just want to give you kind of a brief update on where we are. I'd like to, if I could, review with you.
I think we have a question back to Norris, Representative Cruz.
Yeah, thank you. I guess you kind of piqued my interest when you talk about ag study. And part of the reason is we've got the 10-10 process going on now to make determinations there. So what is this? Is this duplicative of that, or an overlap of that, or a totally different direction? Or
well, I think what it is really to look at and identify what the scientific basis is on which agricultural lands are managed and the various practices that are used, as those are kind of relevant to the meeting the goals of the Oregon plan. So the analogy that I would make is it's basically an analog of what we're doing with the forestry project. We were taking a look at what the regulations are in forestry and also in the voluntary measures that are a key part of the Oregon plan, and evaluating the adequacy of them from a scientific standpoint in order to achieve the goals of the Oregon plan. So envision much the same basic approach with respect to ag lands.
Thank you. I guess I question the timing, since we are right in the middle of 10-10 planning, and it seemed to me that you would be able to get a better data set once those plans have been developed and we know where we're going with them. It seems to me that you're going to come out with all sorts of different things that may not be related, or something that's going to become dictatorial to the local folks, which is absolutely the opposite direction we've been trying to go with this basin planning.
Well, it's a terribly big job, and so one, I think you have to begin and see where the process takes you. I anticipate that first of all, let me say that I'm sure it'll take more than a year for us to do the work that we anticipate doing with respect to ag. I'm sure that a portion of what we will do will be to examine some of the management plans that you were just describing to determine whether there is a sound scientific basis on which they are proceeding or not, as best that we can judge. So it's unfortunate, of course, that all of this work couldn't have been done several years ago, so that then the 10-10 planners could have a better basis on which to proceed, but that just isn't how it was structured.
If I might just bring it to focus a little bit, Representative Dr. Norris, your work will analyze whether we're heading towards the right goals, not necessarily what time frame we ought to get there or how we ought to achieve those goals. Is that right?
That is correct, yes.
I guess, Mr. Chair, we went into the 10-10 process basically what we told the landowners, the farmers out there, is that there are two ways we can proceed here. You guys can either all come together and develop a basin plan that meets the criteria, and one that you can work and one that you can deal with, or somebody else is going to come in and do it for you. And it's been a struggle to get the buy-in of the local folks to do that. But the buy-in has been happening as we've been going out and working the plan. And so here they are in the middle of this process, and here comes this state group that's going to come in and tell them whether they're doing it right or not. So it's almost like we told them that they could do the process, they could own the process, and in the middle of it, here's this oversight group coming in and telling them whether they're doing it right or not. And I think it's a very dangerous message to be sending.
I want to comment again, Representative. I think it's healthy to have an oversight of this process, and I don't see it the way you do necessarily, that this is going to be telling the landowner through the process, or whether even we're looking at the process. What I see we're looking at is that how does what we're trying to accomplish on the land apply to the Oregon plan and the recovery of the species? And I think that leaves a lot of latitude both for the legislature and the process to operate within their report, hopefully.
Well, I believe that's what the outcome of this will be. And if you understand that adaptive management is, in fact, applying what you learn as you go, I think that there will undoubtedly continue to be things that are going to come out of science that will probably continue to influence management in the future. So I appreciate the political sensitivity that's been raised here, but I'm going to argue that to have a critical evaluation of the scientific and technical aspects of this, I think they're just quite important to achieving the goals of the Oregon plan.
Okay. I just one short follow-up, Mr. Chair, and that's the fact that the success of the Oregon plan has always been based on a bottom-up approach and to get the buy-in of the landowners, because they're the ones that actually have to go out and do the work. And anything that jeopardizes the cooperative spirit, I think, for whatever reason, is counterproductive to the ultimate goal.
Any other questions, comments?
Make one additional comment here with the topic we were just discussing. One of the strategies that the team is using in an attempt to be sure that we continue to be connected and informed is to indicate team members who will serve in liaison roles with various groups around the state. So, for instance, the Healthy Streams Partnership, I think, is a terribly important part of what's underway in the Oregon plan. So one of our team members is designated to be the liaison with that particular group, and in fact, I believe meets with them periodically as they meet. We have other team members doing the same. What I've provided you here is a proposed program budget for the team in the next fiscal year, and I'd like to make just a couple of comments about it. The initial level of team activity was funded at about 20% of an individual's effort. And what we found, and basically as we discussed previously, that's a level of activity that's really quite unrealistic given the scope and the complexity of the task that we are faced with. And I would just ask you to remember kind of where we started. We started with Coho on the North Coast and Central Coast, and from there we've gone to all salmonids in the entire state. So indeed it's a very large, complex, and sometimes quite a daunting task. as I've asked, following our the last meeting that we had, as I asked team members to make an assessment of the magnitude of the task as they saw it, their estimate was it was going to take at least half time of members of the team. In further analysis, what we find is that that's not something we can do. And it just boils down to the fact that all the members of the team, in fact, are fully engaged with any number of other activities and individual assignments. And so I've tried to put together a budget here that I think, while there's some variation among team members, I think it's going to be able to meet the needs that are required to accomplish the goals set for this team. So what we've determined as a result of a survey that we did is that team members are basically spending about a third of their time on this effort, and I think that's a level that they are able to sustain, and one that I think will meet the needs of the Oregon plan if we can increase the efficiency with which we're able to do our work. So what I've, the way that we've built this particular budget is an attempt to, first of all, provide the funds that are needed to cover the time that team members are putting into this project. And then, secondly, to increase our efficiency by adding some staffing in the group that I call research assistants. So the proposed budget here basically covers the team salary costs in addition to the three technical specialists that I think that this team member needs in order to help them with research and writing and editing. And I believe that that is a budget that will help us accomplish the task that we've taken on and that I believe you expect us to accomplish.
I'm wondering, Dr. Norris, has this budget been presented to the governor or to the co-chairs or leadership?
No, sir, it has not. This was delivered here to you today. I'd point out, Representative Meserly, that the indirect cost line is zero. It says it's to be negotiated with my university. I'm sure you'll help me with that when we get to that point, won't you?
Well, we already have. But we do need to do some more work on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. North, I didn't want to make it sound like I was ungrateful or disparaging of the work that IMST is doing. You are doing good and valuable work. I just wanted to express some concerns over what we do up here for very good reason and the impact it might have on the local efforts that are going on.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Any other questions or comments? Dr. North, I apologize that we haven't been interacting during this last 6 months like we would have desired to do. Hopefully, as we get into the interim, we can have more time to, when we go to full-day meetings, and we can get more in depth. But we would look forward to that. I, too, want to say that we do appreciate the work, how essential it is to moving forward, and for the amount of time that you folks allot yourself to do this, I'm sure you're spending a lot of free time. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Committee, an audience, just want you to know what this job is like. On my agenda, it says we'll have Ms. Holman give us our Measure 66 updates. My staff is telling me that Ferrioli is going to take care of that. Ferrioli's on the other side of me telling me that Jeanette's going to take care of that. So, Jeanette, you won. Would you come forward and help us out?
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think it's important to note for the record that Jeanette will do the job in half the words that I will do the job in.
Thank God.
That's so noted.
That's for the record.
I would think, Mr. Chair, that would be a given.
That's generous.
Jeanette, please. Go ahead. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Jeanette Holman from Legislative Council. As you all know, I visited with most of you who are not on the Ways and Means Subcommittee earlier today and tried to explain as much of these amendments as you wanted to hear in a short period of time. I'm just going to run through very quickly what the Ways and Means Subcommittee has been doing through House Bill 3225 in the last few weeks and try to explain some of the reasons that we have done some of these things. The amendments that are right now before the Ways and Means Subcommittee are the A20 amendments, and this is a set of amendments that is made up of changes that people from legislative council, from the committee, from the governor's office, and the interested people have all mentioned in the Ways and Means Subcommittee, and corrections to some of the things that we did in 3225 that needed to be fixed. The first thing we have done is propose a change in the definition of capital expenditures. Contrary to what some of you may have heard or read today, this change is not to provide funds for local watershed council management. This change is to include in the capital expenditures definition things that are not necessarily connected to a project, but that are a traditional one-year use or longer type of capital expenditure. An example of this that comes to my mind is shared equipment, some of which the use attainability analysis equipment that was used was purchased by GWEB last interim to be used by a number of different entities. And those kinds of things would not be covered under the definition of capital expenditures as we put it in the bill from this committee. So it's those kinds of expenses that we want to make sure we aren't prohibiting through our definition. The other thing we've done is put in the park subaccount, taking care of giving the money from the park subaccount to the Parks and Recreation Department. This was a change that we needed to do to make everything fit with the Parks Department's budget. We have changed the distribution of the interest earnings for the Restoration and Protection subaccount. This will now go into a new account called the Restoration and Protection Research Fund, along with interest from the Watershed Improvement Grant Fund and the Watershed Improvement Operating, or Watershed Improvement Operating Fund, is what we call it. And this interest is not addressed in the constitutional provision. There's nothing in the Constitution about what is to be done with the interest. We're putting it all into this account to be used for some of the things that I believe this committee wanted the funds to be used for, but couldn't fit them into the traditional capital expenditures list. Things like ocean research is probably a good example of some of the things that money would be used for. No one knows for sure how much interest will be generated. I think the plan is to sit and watch for at least one by one. The other thing we've done is in 3225A as it left this committee, we had given directions to the Watershed Enhancement Board to kind of watch the 65-35 split to make sure that it was spent appropriately. And to make that easier, we've established two separate funds where the two amounts will go. The Watershed Improvement Grant Fund, which is an existing account, will receive the 65% for capital expenditures to be used for capital expenditures. We've created the Watershed Improvement Operating Fund, which will receive the 35%, and those monies will be used for non-capital expenditures, capital expenditures, if there's any extra, and the expenses of the Watershed Enhancement Board and some of the allocations to the agency. We've moved around a little bit of language about sharing technical staff from the Watershed or the Parks and Natural Resources Fund to Section 12 where it seems to fit better. We've established a Restoration and Protection Research Fund. This fund will be able to be used for activities like monitoring, evaluation, and assessment activities under the Oregon Plan, as well as research that's not related to a particular project. We've established the operating fund. We've corrected some language. When we had the bill before this committee, we looked at, we changed the Soil and Water Conservation District small grants that were allowed under the old GWEB program and changed that to a grant program that was Oregon Watershed and Food Enhancement Board will establish by rule, and we made some changes to the statute to go along with that change. We deleted some language that was in the Watershed Improvement Grant Fund and pertaining to investment and interest on that fund that no one really could remember why we put it in last session, so we took it out. We've resolved some conflicts with some existing bills. We changed the legal fund, which you may recall was established to help defray some legal expenses if people are challenged under the Endangered Species Act. We've actually established that as a real fund and set it up so that when money gets appropriated to that fund, it can be accessed by the Department of Justice. And finally, the last thing we've done is in a number of places in the statutes as they exist now, there are references to the Oregon Coastal Salmon Restoration Initiative, and we've changed all of those references to the Oregon plan, which is the more appropriate term at this point in our process. And that's it, and I'd be glad to answer questions.
Very good, thank you. Have any questions from the committee? This has been a long process, but I think we're actually going to get there. Got somebody first?
Yeah, I got just something that just occurred to me there. That when you're talking about the the grant program, the cell districts, that was the small grant program, not in GWEB, not the grant program that was in Department of Ag, right? Because there were two.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cruz, the language that we have been changing was the language in the Governor's Watershed Enhancement Board statute that allowed a person to apply directly to the Soil and Water Conservation District for a grant under a certain amount. And that's what we changed to allow them to set up an grant.
I just want to clarify that we're talking about just one and not universal.
Okay. Any other questions? Comments?
The Restoration Protection Research Fund is administered by?
It will continue to be administered by the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board.
Okay. Right. Any other questions? Thank you, Jeanette. Ken Burley? There he is.
For the record, my name is Tim Beerley, Program Manager with the Governor's Watershed Enhancement Board. In our keeping with the effort to maintain the pulp industry in the state, I've handed out a bit of paper. And you've previously gotten materials that summarize the 95-97 biennium, and I'd like to talk about the two packages that you're getting now. One of them is a summary of the implementation of the 97-99 biennium that was put together to describe where the funds came from and where they went to. You will notice in that there were some statewide allocations, some allocations that reflect budget notes, some grants to assist industry compliance, assistance to watershed councils, and then regional distribution as shown. And also some effort to summarize the types of projects that were done by specific geographic regions. This material I've included for your information. What I would like to talk about specifically is the handout that's called Lessons from the Biennium, to give you a brief summary of what I have learned of this biennium through the effort to implement the Oregon Plan for Salmon and Watershed through the Governor's Watershed Enhancement Board. And in the room is one of our board members, Wayne Krieger, who is from your district, I believe, Representative Messerly, who sits on our board, represents the Board of Forestry, represents the people of the South Coast quite well, and brings a world of knowledge to our board.
Excuse me, Wayne, would you wave your hands so everyone knows who you are? Thank you.
He also is a member of the South Coast Watershed Council, and probably sits on the district or works with the Southern Water Conservation District down there. When you shift the program that for nearly a decade has administered approximately $500,000 to $1 million to a program that is now administering $23 million, there are some program demands that are, we're trying to address. There has been, as Jay mentioned, an effort and an awareness of people statewide that there is a concern about water quality and fish habitat throughout the state. We've also been started to see a problem result as a lack of or a decline through time of local capacity. Funding for federal agencies, state agencies, technical capacity in local communities has declined over the last decade, and we're identifying that many communities don't have technical assistance in their local communities. NRCS has pulled out of Bothell, Oregon, other places around the state where there are no longer agency capacity to assist local communities. And that's led to some frustration. We've identified through the watershed councils and discussing with Southern Water Conservation District some local needs for technical assistance. We've been trying to provide training and coordination of agency efforts so that there can be efficient delivery of services. But we recognize that that will be an ongoing need, more effective coordination and communication between agencies, and providing the appropriate technical assistance in local communities will be a continuing challenge.
Can I note, you say there's 25 new councils. Aren't we up to 92 total now, which is from 38 last biennium?
Over the last biennium, there have been, this is Ken's estimate of about 25 new councils. I think when we started the biennium, there were some 60 councils. There's approximately 90 of one kind or another. And we have funded, used the $2.4 million that's been dedicated to support watershed councils and match that with some federal money. We have requests before us now for about $3.5 million for watershed council support for the next biennium. We have been clear with watershed councils that we need to figure out how to allocate these resources around the state, that increasing level of funds for watershed council support cannot be a continued guarantee. And that discussion, our board has challenged staff to bring back some policy options to the board to discuss ways in which we can provide some assurance for watershed councils, but make some funding decisions based on either geographic area, number of people, or what other combination of criteria might be appropriate to allocate resources to support watershed councils. It doesn't matter to us how watershed councils organize. What is important to the Governor's Watershed Enhancement Board is what threshold, what criteria will we use to provide state resources, funding. And that is the critical policy issue that's been directed and we've struggled with and have not effectively been able to get our hands around to date, but we're being told that we should come back to our board in August with at least some policy options, so we're wrestling with that issue. The other thing that is a very important to address watershed restoration issues throughout the state is to ensure that soil and water conservation districts are healthy, that $2.4 million that was made available for technical assistance to soil and water conservation districts has been utilized very effectively by those districts to assist in landowner compliance, to assist with the development of of farm plans for local landowners, and we think that that is a continued investment for the state that is important to the state. Districts have expressed a concern about their administrative capacity when they have technical assistance but no district manager. They are concerned about that, and there is a systemic concern about loss of technical capacity. The number of engineers that are available through NRCS has declined through time. The number of specialists that are available has also declined through time. One issue that I think is very important as you start to deliberate on budgets is the provision of assistance to industry groups to develop incentives for landowner involvement. We have found that direct assistance to industry groups like the Oregon Dairy Farmers Association, the Cattlemen through the WEF program, the Oregon Wildlife Heritage Foundation have provided very direct benefits to watershed improvement, but also it has a connection to landowners that agency assistance typically doesn't do well at. And as we put together a budget, I think it is important to consider these opportunities and avenues for providing assistance through other than agency avenues. And what we have seen with these programs, the Oregon Wildlife Heritage Foundation, for example, has taken $500,000 this biennium and put more than $3.5 million worth of projects on the ground using industry money for the $3 million with the state's investment of $500,000. So that 7-to-1 match has put a lot of work on the ground with the investment on the part of the state for a small portion of that. What we have also tried to do this biennium is create some tools for these local watershed groups. Watershed Assessment Manual is a tool that significant number of watershed councils are using to assess conditions in a similar manner throughout the state and to identify the unique characteristics of their watershed that require restoration or enhancement. We're hoping to have, by the end of this week, water quality monitoring guidelines that will be available that help local community groups develop monitoring approaches that would be useful across the state. The water quality monitoring guidelines have been developed by an interagency effort to develop a single standard that folks can use that would make their data useful. We've also provided aquatic habitat restoration guidelines, or guidelines that will assist landowners, watershed councils, soil and water conservation districts in minimizing the potential for take under the Endangered Species Act and to meet requirements for restoration. We've also tried to, and the state has invested in, technical assistance from the agencies. In the last biennium, there was funding for a number of agencies to provide correct technical assistance to local communities. As you are aware, we have discussed through time with the Joint Oversight Committee the criteria for granting. We had a discussion about whether or not state or federal agencies should be eligible for grants from the Governor's Watershed Enhancement Board. The legislation 3225 clarifies that debate in a crystallized manner, make sure that if they're eligible, then they are a co-applicant, they are not eligible on their own. But when that discussion arose, when the Oversight Committee raised that issue with the board adopted rules that essentially came to that same conclusion, that state or federal agencies were eligible only if the project could not be carried out by a watershed council and if it were part of a broader effort than watershed council effort. So it was, we concurred with that. Our board adapted to the recommendations from the Oversight Committee. We have had continuing discussion with the co-chairs and with the Joint Legislative Committee also on the focus of educational efforts. And we got clear direction and adopted in rule a preference for educational efforts that are directed towards landowners and people who would be implementing projects. So that has been developed through dialogue with the Oversight Committee through the interim. We are seeing a movement towards funding projects that result from an assessment, so that once a council or people in the basin develop a watershed assessment, identify an action plan, we anticipate moving towards investing in the implementation of that action plan, so that we review at broader scale than project by project. This is a bit of a difference in approach, but I think it is a healthy direction to assist in watershed councils in implementation of their efforts and get them through the micromanagement of the grant review process. We have also had discussions about whether it would be appropriate to make sure that watershed councils approve projects, or this came over a discussion by an individual from Watershed Council of the Mid-Coast, where there was a significant disagreement within the council on whether or not it was approved locally, and where the board approved the project. But there was concern about what the role of Watershed Council's support of that project should be in the grant application review process. And while we have not resolved that, have not made Watershed Council approval a condition of the granting, we have made sure that we know where Watershed Councils are on each one of the applications that are submitted to us. I'm trying to answer that issue. Over the last biennium, we have shifted from a state-level review process to a regional review process. There are five regions around the state where interdisciplinary teams get together to review projects, so that the people that are reviewing projects are more familiar with the geography and conditions in the watersheds that they're trying to make recommendations to the board on. And we have found that, in general, that process worked well. I spent over the weekend reading the independent scientific review panel for the Northwest Power Planning Council review of Bonneville Power Administration's granting process. And it's interesting that some of the recommendations that have come out of that federal grant process are similar to the direction that the GWEB board has taken our program, and there are some very instructive lessons that we can bring to the GWEB OWEB program from the independent scientific review of the Bonneville efforts. One of the things that's become clear is that we need a little bit different process for reviewing and evaluating watershed council support grants. They are a little different than Project X that's going to fix culvert Y or fence riparian area B. We need to figure out a better way to evaluate whether or not a watershed council is making progress. And I have seen some efforts from Australia, self-evaluation efforts out of land care groups that have been established in Australia that might be applicable to watershed councils, and so that they could do a self-evaluation and assist us in the continued support for watershed councils and the evaluation of their efforts. It is clear also that it would help to have explicit and specific regional goals and objectives that both local groups, local citizens could recognize and address, and then the review teams for projects could help us to identify and to utilize in evaluating projects. So I think that is an important element. It's one that's specific in House Bill 3225 at this time. As I close out here, we have worked hard to coordinate this grant program with other grant programs. We're trying to make sure that we're trying to create a better level of consistency of projects through the granting process. We're trying to integrate the monitoring efforts more effectively, and we're struggling with that. The difference between monitoring an individual project and monitoring in a basin, the outcome of an accumulation of projects in the basin are two different things, and trying to get those in sync is a difficult issue. So I think that there is, since we've learned a lot of this last biennium, I think as we move into the next biennium, the clarifications and the focus of effort under the House Bill 3225 will assist us in carrying that out. Other than that, I'd be glad to answer questions.
Yeah,
you're hitting 5 o'clock.
Can I, I'm reflecting here on where we were 2 years ago and where your agency or your group is. I think we've made tremendous progress, and I appreciate the work you've done. I know you've worked really hard, and not only with the full committee, but with the co-chair and myself, and trying to resolve some of these issues. I think we've made tremendous progress. My question is, when you look at the scope of your job or your group's job 2 years ago and what you're looking at now, and just more watershed councils to work with, more involved with Southern Water Districts, and particularly after we see what happens with the federal monies coming in, whether that will come through your agency or not, tremendously more money to deal with, more grants. Do you feel comfortable that you're geared up and ready for that, or will you be ready for that when it hits July 1? Or just give me a sense of confidence here.
Representative Messerly, the board is prepared to take on the responsibilities. If we're talking about additional federal monies, I don't spend money until I get it. Federal money to me is mythology. And we can use the existing process to deal with additional resources from the federal government if that happens. The magnitude of the program has not increased, will not increase significantly with major 66 funds, particularly the way that budgets are being put together as I understand them. We are asking for a slight increase in staffing. We currently have two staff positions that are basically contracted that would be, we're asking in an option package to increase staffing as well as add two additional staff. So we do anticipate additional staff needs in the fiscal end of the program and in the management end of the program to assist in getting where we need to go. It will take a significant effort to work with the board, particularly when we add to the board members from the current 11 to 16 full membership of the board. So it will take some additional coordination there, and that's some of the management, additional management positions. But I have every confidence both with the staffing and with the board in place and the language in 3225 that allows this board to continue until a new board is in place. We can continue assistance to local groups and entities without interruption.
I'd like to ask Wayne Krager if you would give any comments. If you'd like to, it's not very often you have an opportunity to have a... Remember, do you want to ask questions prior to Mr. Krager?
Yeah, if I could, Mr. Chair. When we talk about staffing, are you still planning? I mean, you're talking about a couple additional. I know that to do the work you've had in the governor's office, you had to borrow staff from agencies, and is that still going to be the practice? Or
under the current option package, Representative Cruz, under the current option package, we would, instead of having limited duration position and shared positions, we would have full-time positions that and would be independent of governor's office under this term, under the proposal.
I understand, Mr. Chair, but you had the people you had borrowed from other natural resource agencies, I mean, that maybe not full-time, but on part-time basis, that came in and did work, and so I was wondering if that practice is still going to continue, or if you're looking at... what I remember was, there was a lot of folks that have done work for GLEB in the past that weren't part of the governor's office, and I guess it's fairly easy for the governor to borrow folks for specific reasons and then give them back when he's done with them, sort of thing. Is that practice still going to continue, or are you looking at a permanent staff to do all the things that you borrowed folks from other agencies to do?
Representative Cruz, the only activity in which the Governor's Watershed Enhancement Board has utilized other agency staff has been their contributions to technical advisory committees, both technical advisory committee and educational advisory committee, as well as the regional review committees. And that has been for very specific purposes. We anticipate continuing that practice. We have not borrowed staff on a full-time or even limited duration other than by establishing our own limited duration position for one data management position. The Governor's Watershed Enhancement Board has operated differently than the Governor's Natural Resource Office in that regard. We have not borrowed staff for ongoing management of the program.
Wayne?
Representative Nesley, the one thing I might speak to just...
Wayne, I'm sorry, I need your name for the record.
Wayne Krieger from Gold Beach, and I'm on the Board of Forestry representing the board on the DLEB board. The one thing I've many times heard to see concern about the cost of coordinators in the program of DLEB. And every time we do have a grant applications, we continue to get more of those applications. It seems that at some point we're going to have every stream in the state going to have a coordinator. However, I want to bring to your attention the fact that experience I had in Gold Beach before we actually had a coordinator, we had 5 to 10 people show up at our meetings, and assignments would be given, and a month later you meet, you would find out that most of the things people were assigned to do didn't get done, and the watershed conference business did not move forward. The coordinators we're getting now are very talented young people. They're dedicated to their work, and they are the things that drive the consul, and that the things actually are accomplished on the ground. And I think that needs to be reiterated, the fact that without coordinators, things don't move at the watershed council level on the ground. We need to always keep that in mind.
Good. Appreciate that. Any comments, questions of Mr. Krieger or Mr. Burley? Thank you very much. We'll adjourn the meeting. As it stated for committee members, we're going to try to have one more meeting at least before we get out of the building. We've got